All right, thank you very much. Thank you for having me back. So let me give you the quick preview. So this is based on work together with Daniel Bauman and Dan Green, who are both cosmologists. And the idea here was, in the last few years, we've learned quite a bit about correlation functions in conformal field theory. There have been developments on analytic bootstrap and Lorentzian inversion and OPE methods and dispersion relations. So we've learned quite a bit about correlation functions in CFT. And the question was, can we take some of this technology that's been developed in CFT and learn something about inflation? Because inflationary correlators are similar to CFT correlators. And so what I'll tell you about is our attempts to do that. In anti-de-Sitter, I'm going to actually tell you about two different flavors of results, some in ADS and some in DS. Okay, so in anti-de-Sitter, we put the boundary at space-like infinity, and there's a emergent holographic direction, the z direction, the radial direction, and we calculate correlation functions on that boundary. De-Sitter space is a similar geometry. It has a similar set of symmetries. But the boundary of De-Sitter is at future infinity, and the analog of the radial direction is now time. So in De-Sitter, we calculate future correlators, and the future correlators in De-Sitter are relevant for inflation and the CMB. In anti-De-Sitter, you can roughly think of the radial direction as an RG direction. And when you have a non-trivial RG flow, it means there's some non-trivial scale dependence in the z direction. So there's something similar in inflation, which is that inflation isn't really De-Sitter space. It's quasi-De-Sitter space. So it's approximately De-Sitter for a while, but the Hubble is slowly rolling. So the Hubble scale is changing as a function of time. So that is kind of like a rotated version of an RG flow in ADS. So formally speaking, you can get between these two geometries by some Wick rotations, taking T and the coordinates and the cosmological constant to include some I's. But this is just a formal procedure. It's been long wondered whether there's a real DS-CFT correspondence that allows you to do quantum gravity in De-Sitter. The answer to that, I would say, is still, that question is still open. We don't really have a DS-CFT correspondence because this Wick rotation makes a big difference. It's now time that's the emergent direction, and it's not really clear whether there is a DS-CFT for quantum gravity. But for our purposes, that won't really matter. All we need is this formal relationship between observables in conformal field theory and certain observables at Scribe-Plus and De-Sitter. And the conclusions that I'll reach by the end of the talk won't rely on having any kind of real DS-CFT correspondence for quantum gravity. It'll just be, basically, we're going to take results in ADS and use that as a way of motivating a set of tools for studying correlation functions in DS. Good. So this is what I just said. In this talk, I'll describe some observables where we can use this result to derive some new results for cosmology. And the final results are facts about QFT during inflation that do not rely on any speculations about DS-CFT. It's really just for motivation to get the setup. So first, let me set up the theory that we're talking about during inflation. So as I said, in inflation, the Hubble scale L tilde here is changing. The De-Sitter size is increasing with time. Hubble is decreasing. And in that situation, the time diffeomorphism is broken. And there's an effective field theory that encodes that breaking of the time diffeomorphisms and gives you an effective field theory for fluctuations during inflation. So this is called the effective field theory for single field inflation. And what it does is it encodes that time diffeomorphism symmetry acting nonlinearly on the fluctuations. So the way this works is you take your inflaton phi and you expand it, and your metric and you expand your metric, the rolling background breaks the time diffeomorphisms where you shift eta. And you can use the Stackelberg method to construct an effective field theory for the symmetry breaking pattern. And that's the effective field theory for the Goldstone during inflation. This was done by Cliff Chung and collaborators, and also by Weinberg about 10 years ago, and they constructed this effective field theory. We write things out very explicitly because we're going to be relying on the format of this action. So in FRW coordinates, there are a few terms that we're going to care about in the effective field theory of inflation. So the first term that I've written here is just the action for the quadratic fluctuations. Okay, so the thing to notice here is that this is a non-relativistic action. So there's a CS here, which tells you that there's a non-trivial speed of sound. That's the speed of sound during inflation. And that's a parameter of the effective theory. Because we've broken the symmetries, we're allowed to have that non-trivial CS. So that's the speed of sound. This is the quadratic term. And the nonlinear symmetry controls also the interacting terms. So the next few terms look something like this. So there are some cubic terms. Because of the broken symmetries, we can have explicit phi dots showing up, time derivatives of the Goldstone. So there's some cubic terms and there's some quartic terms. The nonlinear symmetry relates some of the coefficients here. So in particular, that speed of sound that shows up in the quadratic interactions also shows up again in the cubic and quartic interactions. So there are various relations among the coupling constants here. During inflation, that first line, the quadratic fluctuations, that's the standard. Those are the terms that you get in standard slow roll inflation. And the additional terms from the interactions, those are responsible for the non-Gaussianities in the CMB. We're going to be working in the decoupling limit, which is a limit G Newton to zero in this effective field theory. This decouples the graviton. And in this limit, inflation is just a theory of a single non-relativistic scalar field. So this is the theory that we're interested in. We just have this non-relativistic QFT for a scalar field in a fixed background. Now, we'd like to understand what the coupling constants can be and what the possible effective field theories are. So this is something that's been studied a lot in relativistic field theories. For example, we have dispersion relations that control different higher derivative operators. We know about sign constraints. Certain couplings have to be positive or negative or related to each other. But in a non-relativistic theory, most of that stuff goes out the window. So in this non-relativistic theory, we don't really know what the rules are for this Lagrangian, what couplings are allowed, a lot of the analogous things with dispersion relations that we can do in the relativistic setting. So that is part of the problem that we want to address. So there were some steps taken in this direction a few years ago by Bauman, Green, Lee, and Porto. And they made a conjecture about this effective field theory that was based on some examples that they looked at and some attempts to construct non-relativistic dispersion relations. And here's the conjecture that they made. They conjectured that there should be some kind of dispersion relation for the speed of sound. Okay, they didn't find one. They found some other dispersion relations, but they had an indirect argument based on causality that there should be some kind of dispersion relation like this. And furthermore, they conjectured that the only consistent theory with the speed of sound equal to one is the free scalar. So in other words, if you set the speed of sound to one, then the Goldstone boson is just trivial. If something like this is true, like this conjecture, then this is important for observation because it means that the observations that we'll actually make in the CMB can be used not just to measure the speed of sound, which is what they do directly, but to constrain the whole effective field theory of single field inflation. Because if we can, so if we get constraints on the speed of sound, the longer we go without seeing non-Gaussianities, the stronger these constraints will become. At this point, the constraint on CS is fairly weak from Planck, but with stronger constraints, that'll get pushed closer to one, assuming we don't see non-Gaussianities, and then we'd like to be able to conclude something about the effective theory just from measuring this one couple. So in this talk, I'm going to use these methods borrowed from ADS-CFT that I'll tell you about to try to understand the status of this conjecture. So the first part of the conjecture, that there should be a dispersion relation for the speed of sound, we will construct that dispersion relation. Okay, so that was correct. The second part of the conjecture is trickier, and I'll come back to this. There's a dispersion relation, but we can't quite make this conclusion about the theory being free. The analogous thing turns out to be true in anti-de Sitter, but we'll see why things are different in de Sitter. So here's the strategy to study this question. We're going to start by setting up the analogous problem in ADS. Then we're going to adapt these recent CFT and bootstrap methods to solve the problem in ADS. We'll find something there that's interesting on its own, which is constraints on RG flows in ADS. Okay, so we'll study these the effective theory of RG flows, and we'll find constraints on that theory. And then we'll take what we learned in ADS and try to go back to de Sitter and see what we find. Okay. Any questions at this point? So the first step is to set up this analogous problem in ADS. And we know from the pictures at the beginning that this is going to have something to do with constraining RG flows, holographic RG flows. So I just want to describe these holographic RG flows and what kind of observable it is that we're interested in. As I said, the anti-de Sitter analog of inflation is a holographic RG flow. In terms of the geometry, this just means a geometry where the scale factor is z-dependent. So we put in that function c of z, which is the holographic c function that controls the scale factor along the RG flow. So it's basically just ADS with a scale-dependent cosmological constant. This geometry is dual to a quantum field theory flowing from the UV to an IR fixed point. And the analog of the speed of sound. So in inflation, we have the speed of sound, which tells you about the different kinetic terms in the time direction versus the space directions. You have the same kind of thing here. There's a radial speed that I'll call c sub z that controls how fast things fall into ADS. In empty ADS, just vacuum ADS, without an RG flow, things fall inward at the speed of light. So the ADS isometries set this speed equal to the transverse speeds. But in RG flow, this is not the case, so there's this extra speed parameter c sub z. So if we drop an object from the boundary into the radial direction, that's this red line, we drop something in a CFT, it goes in at the speed of light. dz dt is 1. If an object is falling in at the speed of light, that's dual to the fact that in a conformal field theory, if you insert a local operator, it's going to spread out at the speed of light. So what's happening on the boundary is you inserted some local operator, it created some excitations that are spreading out at the speed of light because it's a CFT. In an RG flow, the speed of infall is less than 1. So things experience sort of a time delay as they fall inward, and c sub z is less than 1. The CFT interpretation of all this is that we have an RG flow, so we want to take a CFT in the UV and deform by a relevant operator. The infall experiment that I just described is dual to a picture on the boundary where a local operator is spreading out in time. Okay, so I'm now this is a CFT picture. I'm inserting an operator at time zero, and this gray blob is just the, denotes the spread of the operator. Okay, so we insert, as I said, we insert an operator in CFT, it just spreads out at the speed of light. But if it's not a, so if it's a CFT, this is just scale invariant process. But in an RG flow, this is actually probing the RG flow. Because in an RG flow, this operator starts out as effectively a UV operator, but then once it spreads out, it needs to be governed by the infrared theory. Okay, so this T here is real T. It's the real physical time, but it's sort of becoming RG, it's becoming the parameter along the RG flow because the physical excitation is spreading out. So you could think of this as a dynamical probe of the RG flow. You're just perturbing the theory, and you're watching as the UV modes sort of spread out and become infrared modes, and you want to know the dynamics of how that occurs. In a CFT, local operators spread at the speed of light, but in general quantum field theories, they don't. So in general, there's a mass, and at scales around the mass, you don't expect things to spread as fast as light. So we expect some kind of picture like this, where in a UV, deep UV, it acts like a CFT, things spread out, then it notices that it has a mass, things slow down, eventually it's at the infrared fixed point, and things spread at the speed of light again. During inflation, the Hubble constant changes slowly. So that's the regime that we're going to look at also in ADS. So in ADS, the analog of that is to say that the scale factor changes slowly. So we're going to look at these slow RG flows. And when the scale factor changes slowly, it means that the infall speed is constant for a long time. Okay, so instead of having this totally general curve that can do crazy things, you just have a nice linear spread of excitations, but it's a spread of excitations at less than the speed of light. And that is the parameter C sub z. So these boundary operators are spreading at C sub z. This spreading of operators, I think, is something that should be possible to define generally in any quantum field theory, holographic or not. But the only way I know how to define it precisely is in holographic theories. So in holographic theories, we have a precise understanding of what it means for what it means for the operator to spread, and we can ask how big a region do you need on the boundary at time t in order to reconstruct that operator. In general, I don't really know exactly how we're supposed to define it, but this is going to be enough for our purposes because we're just studying holographic RG flows. I think it would be interesting to try to define this quantity more generally. As an aside here, let me just compare the situation to quantum chaos and what's happened in the last few years with the study of the butterfly effect and its relation to black holes. So this idea of the spreading of an operator is very similar to the kind of thing that people like Douglas Stanford and Steve Schenker have been talking about for the last few years at finite temperature and studying black holes and its relation to quantum chaos. So they're looking at a thermal state, and they're looking at CFTs in a thermal state. And the spread of an operator is governed by what's called the butterfly curve or the butterfly velocity. Here, we're discussing the same thing, the spreading rate of a local operator, but we're doing it in the vacuum of a non-trivial QFT, non-conformal QFT. So the usual butterfly, so it's the same kind of idea, but the butterfly effect is measuring the spread of operators in the thermal state of a CFT, and here we're talking about the spread in vacuum, but with a mass term turned on. Okay, so this is the observable that we're trying to probe. It's this spreading speed in RG flow. Now I'm going to turn to what we can say about the speed and where it shows up in the effective theory. So in the in a holographic RG flow, there's an effective field theory for the RG flow, which is very similar to the effective field theory of inflation. So this was written down by Kaplan and Wang. And it's basically almost the same theory that we had for the EFT of inflation. Now it's been wick rotated a few times. So we have the same kinds of terms. Pi is now the radian mode. It's the radian mode in ADS. And here are the interactions that we're going to care about. So in the quadratic term, we see that speed of sound, speed of infall showing up. This is controlling how fast things fall in the radial direction. And then in the interacting terms, we see breaking of the ADS symmetries, because these pi dots here are explicit z derivatives of the fields. So we see breaking of the ADS symmetries, but the nonlinear symmetry relates these coefficients to each other in various ways. So we see CZ showing up all over the place in that effective field. In this case, the Goldstone pi is the bulk field, which is dual to the trace of the stress tensor. Okay, so we've turned on an RG flow, there's now a trace. And so what we've written down here is a holographic effective field theory for trace T in an RG flow. This is the effective field theory of trace T. So that is the problem that we're studying in ADS. It's the effective theory of trace T. And now we're going to study this problem of dispersion relations and constraints. In particular, we're interested in what the constraints are, or dispersion type constraints, on CZ, the speed in the radial direction. And we're interested in this limit where the speed is set to 1. The question there is, if we set the speed to 1, does it make the theory free? OK, so we're going to adapt some recent CFT methods to solve this problem. The ADS symmetries are broken. But here, unlike in De Sitter, we know the rules for this Lagrangian. This is just an RG flow. And we know what it does in the UV. It flows to a CFT. So we had this when I talked about De Sitter, we had this trouble that it was a non-relativistic theory. And we were sort of confused about what kind of dispersion relations we could write down. We didn't really understand the UV behavior of the amplitudes. Now, this is just dual to a CFT. The UV is under complete control. We know what the rules are. It has to be unitary and obey all the good properties of a CFT in the UV. What we want is a dispersion relation for the infall speed C sub z. In that Lagrangian that I wrote up a couple slides back, there was one promising looking term, which was CZ squared minus 1 times d pi to the 4th. So why is this term of interest? Well, there are well-known constraints in a relativistic, in ordinary relativistic theory in flat space. There are well-known constraints on interaction terms like this one. This is the famous d pi to the 4th constraint of Adams and collaborators from about 10 years ago. That terms like this have to come with a certain sign and come with dispersion relations that can be used to control the theory if you set this coupling to 0. So that's why we're particularly interested in this term. And we want to write down a dispersion relation that extracts that term from the correlation functions. OK, so we're going to use this technology of CFT dispersion relations that's been developed over the last few years. I'm going to not go too much into the details of how this technology works, but I'm going to summarize the basic picture. So the basic point of this work is that spin 2 contributions to the OPE, well, a similar thing is true for higher spin contributions, but in particular, spin 2 contributions to the OPE can be extracted from a dispersion relation for the CFT four-point function. There's two ways of doing this. There's sort of two parallel developments here. There's a set of position space techniques where you integrate the position, where you find dispersion relations in terms of the CFT four-point function in position space. And there's a set of momentum space techniques that are based on deep inelastic scattering. The position space techniques work as follows. You put your you insert your operators in position space in a kinematics like this one. This turns out to be a kinematics where you can extract these higher spin contributions. So it's sort of like a forward limit, but it's in position space. And then you can write a dispersion relation for these spin 2 contributions. That's this lambda 2 thing here. In terms of commutators, or what's called the double discontinuity of the CFT four-point function. Okay, so there are these dispersion relations that take this form. And the thing that's showing up on the right-hand side is an integral over some UV piece of the correlation function. And in the UV, you don't know the correlation function, but as often happens with these dispersion relations and scattering amplitudes, you do know the positivity properties in the UV. So you can conclude that these spin 2 contributions always come with a plus sign. These contributions are always positive. Okay, so these dispersion relations give you they give you a formula for the infrared contribution in terms of the UV correlator, and they give you a positivity condition on the infrared. There's a similar technology in momentum space. I actually don't know if these two methods are 100% equivalent to each other. They seem to be not quite the same, but in most cases, and including in the case that I'll talk about, they give the same seem to give the same set of constraints. But the way the momentum space version works is to study a deep inelastic scattering amplitude that's constructed by the CFT correlator momentum space. I'll write up this amplitude in a slide or two, and then to apply some contour manipulation on this deep DIS amplitude to extract the same spin 2 contribution that we were just talking about. So there's just two different ways of looking at this that give these sorts of constraints. These dispersion relations in CFT have been used for various applications. They give constraints on ADS Lagrangians. So in particular, this is the way to understand why in ADS CFT you can't have d phi to the fourth terms in ADS. If you do have them, they have to come with a certain sign. So if you take a scalar field in ADS and you add a d phi to the fourth term, then you translate that into a statement about the CFT. It's exactly turning on one of these spin 2 contributions that's constrained by a dispersion relation at CFT. Okay, so this is kind of you can kind of think of these as a holographic dual of the usual S matrix dispersion relations that you would construct in the bulk theory. So this has been used to derive constraints on ADS Lagrangians. Purely in CFT, it's been used to derive the conformal collider bounds, which are constraints on OP coefficients of the stress tensor in CFT. We used it to derive the average null energy condition. So the average null energy condition is in CFT is a constraint on how the stress tensor couples to other operators. And it turns out that this spin 2 contribution is exactly the contribution of the average null energy operator. There are higher spin versions of this. What I just described was spin 2, but there are higher spin versions of this, and those have been used to constrain higher spin operators and match to various predictions from CFTs like the Ising model. It's also been, similar ideas have also been used to derive the Einstein gravity three-point functions directly from conformal field theory. So this is not something I'll go into, but you can ask me about later. and is also related to this formula of Karen-Huo, the Lorentzian inversion formula for CFT data. So basically the sum rules that I'm describing are some limit of Karen-Huo's form. Okay. Anyway, back to our application. We're interested in this RG flow, and conformal invariance is broken on the RG flow, but the same method applies. Okay, so in fact, the derivation of these dispersion relations didn't use conformal invariance. It just used OPEs and some nice properties of the correlation functions in the UV. Since we have an RG flow that flows to a CFT in the UV, we can apply the same thing here. The DIS, so I'm gonna describe this calculation in momentum space. Actually, things get very messy in position space. I think probably the same thing would work there, but the momentum space was a little bit easier. So the momentum space dispersion relations come from studying this DIS amplitude. This is a four-point function that's in this limit where we're studying the four-point correlation function of the stress tensor trace, and we're looking in this limit where where you have ingoing P and Q and outgoing P and Q. So we've just set these equal. And this is the thing that we know from these previous results shows up in dispersion relations. So what we're going to do is we're just going to calculate this DIS amplitude using holography and then plug it into this dispersion technology. So this is a bunch of Witten diagrams, which are a little bit painful because this theory is not ADS invariant. So these are Witten diagrams, but they're Witten diagrams in an RG flow, not Witten diagrams in ADS. So we need to calculate this trace four-point function. There are basically two types of terms. There are contact terms that come from this d pi to the fourth interaction in the bulk. Remember, that's the one that looks really interesting from our point of view because it came with this 1 minus c squared coefficient. Okay, so this one we expect to lead to some kind of constraint. It turns out, though, that you can't extract this term by itself. There are exchange diagrams that contribute to the same amplitude. These exchange diagrams come from the fact that the theory is non-relativistic. The fact that the theory has broken ADS symmetry. And when you break the ADS symmetry, you can write derivative interactions that are cubic. Okay, so you wouldn't be able to write this these sort of terms ordinarily, but because of the RG flow, you can write these terms, and this gives additional terms. So there's basically several diagrams like this, and all the crosses, and the one contact term. The whole point of this sum rule technology is then that you can calculate this DIS amplitude and use a dispersion relation to extract the spin 2 piece of that and write down a formula for the spin 2 contribution. I will spare you the details. The result of writing down this dispersion relation looks like this. Okay, so let me explain the ingredients in this equation. For these RG flows, this is our main result. This is a dispersion relation for the coupling constants in the bulk. The coupling constants in the bulk are the speed, Cz, and one of the cubic couplings, lambda 3. F here is some messy function that I didn't want to write down, but it's a known rational function of the couplings. The important thing being that what's showing up is F squared, so that term is just manifestly positive. So on the left-hand side, we have the speed of infall term that came from the contact diagram. And then we have this exchange diagram contribution, which comes out as a perfect square. The dispersion relation relates this term here to the amplitude in the UV. So This comes from writing down a contour integral for the DIS amplitude, deforming the contour, and following the usual procedure. And so in this case, since we're studying the we're studying this Goldstone boson in the bulk, the pi field, that means we're studying the stress tensor trace. So this is a dispersion relation that relates on the left-hand side the couplings in the bulk theory, and on the right-hand side the UV properties of the trace four-point function. Remember, the trace is just the deforming operator. So if we, when we turn on an RG flow, we turn on some operator O with a massive coefficient. And so basically, we're saying that the couplings in the theory are related to the UV properties of that four-point function of the deforming operator. So in bulk language, this is a dispersion relation for the infall speed plus these exchange terms, the F squared term. In QFT language, boundary language, this is a formula that tells us how fast a local insertion of T will spread. If you insert trace T, this is a formula that's governing how fast excitations of trace T will spread in this massive QFT. The limit that we're especially interested in, as I motivated from the effective field theory of inflation, was the limit where this speed is taken to 1. Actually, there's interesting behavior also as this speed is taken to 0, but we're going to look at the limit going to 1. So this dispersion relation, as the speed goes to 1, this combination of, well, it's obvious the first term goes to 0. The second term, it turns out, also goes to 0, even faster. So as you take CZ to 1, the dispersion relation just becomes 0 equals the integral of the imaginary part of this amplitude. The integrand here is non-negative. So the only way you can satisfy this is for the DIS, the imaginary part of this DIS amplitude to vanish. The conclusion then is that in RG flows where signals spread at the speed of light, the effective field theory of T, of trace T, actually has to be trivial. Because once you set this scattering amplitude to 0, you can extract the other couplings in the EFT also from dispersion relations. So once you set this to 0, your whole theory is just trivial. Okay, so the conclusion is that in ADS, if you have an RG flow where the speed is 1, then the effective field theory of the Bolt-Goldstone is just a quadratic term, just has to be a free field. This was a holographic argument. So we're talking about holographic RG flows because we use holography all over the place. But I think there's perhaps some non-holographic version of this. And again, I think it would be interesting to try to study the spread of signals just using ordinary RG techniques in QFT without using holography. We have some hint here of what's supposed to come out of that, especially as C sub Z goes to 1. Any questions?
Sorry. So
yeah.
On the field theory side, the object you'd compute the stress tensor four-point function from is some kind of Legendre transform of the dilaton effective batch, right?
Why do you want to do a Legendre transform?
Or is it just the dilaton? I guess it is just the dilaton.
Yeah, it's just the four-point term and the dilaton effective action. Okay. Yes. Yeah. Other questions?
Exactly, did you have to use holography for to define the spread of signal? Why is that not defined more generally?
So there's a couple ways we can define it holographically. One is just to look at the effective field theory and read off the quadratic term. That's one way to define the speed. A more elaborate way of defining this holographically is using entanglement wedge reconstruction. So this is what's done in the quantum chaos, butterfly, et cetera story, where it's one way to do it. So what you do is you perturb the theory with an operator, and something falls into the bulk. And then you ask, what is the region I need for the entanglement wedge to include that operator? Because if the entanglement wedge includes the operator, then you can reconstruct the operator. So it's the spreading of the entanglement wedge that really defines this curve. I just don't have a definition so those are the holographic definitions. The reason we need a holography to define it is I just don't have a precise definition of this curve in the non-holographic case. I think that intuitively there should be such a curve. I mean, if you insert trace T in a massive theory, you don't expect everything to spread out at the speed of light, but it could certainly be that in non-holographic theories, there's not a sharp cone. In holographic theories, the nice thing is that there's this totally sharp light cone-like behavior, the spreading of excitations in the holographic RG. Okay, any other questions about ADS? I'm going back to the sitter. Okay, so let me recap where we are so far. We started in the sitter, interested in the speed of sound. We set up the analogous problem in ADS, which was to talk about the speed of radial infall and how fast signals spread in an RG flow. And then we adapted these CFT methods to write dispersion relation for CZ. And to understand that as CZ goes to 1, the theory must become trivial because of this dispersion relation, and in particular because there's a positive dispersion relation. Now we're going to go back to the sitter and see what we can see. So our dispersion relation for the speed of infall in ADS took this form. It's 1 minus c squared plus the exchange terms is the imaginary part of this amplitude, integrated over the UV. You are allowed to just double Wick rotate this answer. Okay, so that gives you a dispersion relation for the speed of sound and inflation. So it's very similar. Cz becomes 1 over Cs. So the speed of infall becomes 1 over the inflationary speed of sound because of the double Wick rotation. You get the 1 over. Then there's some exchange terms. And there's something like a DIS amplitude. I'm writing this very schematically because I don't want to try to write out the equation for this. But there's a concrete equation for the thing that shows up in this dispersion relation. So why are you allowed to do this double Wick rotation? This is not something that I think that you can generally do in holography. I don't think you can generally just take ADS and double Wick rotate and get answers in DS. But the point is that we're really just double Wick rotating our method here. Okay, so we're just taking the method, which was understanding where to do our contour integrals and everything in this sum rule in ADS. And then we can just follow exactly the same method in DS, study the amplitudes in DS, and then extract these terms by integrating over the appropriate region. So this is the formula. This is the main result in DS. It's a dispersion relation for the inflationary speed of sound. I want to make some comments about this formula. First of all, that thing showing up on the right-hand side, that is not an inflationary four-point function. It's not a de Sitter correlator. This is because when you take the things that you calculate in ADS and you double Wick rotate them, you don't get correlators in DS. Because in ADS, when we calculate correlators, we freeze the metric. We freeze the fields at the boundary. So when you Wick rotate that back to DS, you get something where you get some observable that's calculated with the fields or sources frozen at scribe plus. That's not a correlation function. To get a correlation function, you'd have to allow those fields to fluctuate. What it is it's a wave function. Okay, so this is the one way of talking about the DS CFT correspondence. that the path integral in DS with future boundary conditions calculates a wave function. So that thing showing up on the right-hand side of this dispersion relation is not an ordinary correlator. It's a variation of the de Sitter wave function that's been analytically continued to unphysical momentum. Why that last part? Well, again, that comes from the analytic continuation. So in ADS, this was an integral over physical momentum, but when you do the double wick rotation, it's not. So there's a bunch of, so the way you would, if we just threw away ADS at this point and just wrote down a dispersion relation in DS, then this is it. It's just a very weird thing to calculate in DS. And if I didn't give the ADS motivation, it would be really hard to see why this would be a good thing to calculate. The thing you're supposed to calculate is the wave function of the universe, its fourth moment, and then analytically continued in some weird way. So is this formula valid? Yes. As I said, this formula can be derived directly in the de Sitter quantum field theory. This interlude to anti-de Sitter was helpful for understanding the kinematics, but it wasn't necessary. This is just a statement about QFT and de Sitter, and it's a strict condition on, so this is a true equation for single field inflation, single field inflation with a decoupling limit in de Sitter. So the formula is true. But now we come to the main difference from ADS, which is the positivity conditions of the integrand. Okay, so when we talked about the going to the speed of light, when we talked about taking the speed equal to 1 in ADS, it was very important that we had a dispersion relation with a positive integrand. That was how we concluded that as C goes to 1, the theory becomes free. In de Sitter, there's no such theorem. Okay, so in ADS, that was a property of the UV CFT. We understood that that UV CFT had to be unitary, and that's where that positivity condition came from. In de Sitter, we have this dispersion relation, but there's no analogous statement that the integrand on the right-hand side has to be positive. It can be positive, and there are lots of examples where it seems to want to be positive. If you write down some reasonable quantum field theory in de Sitter, the right-hand side does seem to be positive, but we can't be sure that it's always positive, especially in the UV, where we can't even, where we don't know what we're supposed to write down, and gravity fluctuates, and we have to do quantum gravity in de Sitter to really understand the UV properties of this amplitude. So that's the difference. It might not be positive in the UV, and understanding this is a difficult question. I'm going to make a conjecture, which is not very well supported by anything, but just sounds to me reasonable, which is that if inflation lasts forever, then the conjecture is that the integrand is positive. Okay, this is similar to what happens. This is motivated by ADS. So in ADS, if you have a well-defined CFT in the UV, that's where you get these positivity conditions. The reason this is hard in DS is because there is no well-defined theory that really has a scry plus. We know that inflation ends, and we exit inflation, and there is no scry plus. But this conjecture is basically saying is that in the limit where there really is a scry plus, then you should have positivity conditions on the sample. So that's just a conjecture. I think is a natural thing to try to aim for in making this positivity condition, understanding this positivity condition. Okay, so looks like I'm going to be done early. Here's the conclusion. The rules of quantum field theory, the rules of doing quantum field theory in de Sitter are still sort of murky, and this hampers our ability to say to make statements about the quantum field theory of single field inflation, just because we don't exactly know what all the rules are on the scattering amplitudes in de Sitter. We don't really know how to write causality constraints for quantum fields in de Sitter. The result that I described is a new dispersion relation connecting infrared to UV observables for quantum fields in DS and in a slowly rolling DS that's relevant to inflation. And in ADS, we derived a dispersion relation for how fast the operators spread along RG flows. One last thing I'll mention is that some of this, so part of the initial motivation that we had, and I still hope this is true, but I don't have a concrete statement, is that some of these results that I've talked about are sign constraints sound similar to the C theorems that you get in RG flow. So a C theorem is a sign constraint that governs an RG flow. And here we are studying sign constraints that govern RG flows. Furthermore, the Komor-Gottske and Schwimmer derivation of the four-dimensional A theorem relies exactly on this, relies on a very similar quantity. So that derivation comes from studying dispersion relations for the trace four-point function. It's not quite the same dispersion relation that I've written here, but there does seem to be some relation between these. And so this would be really interesting to understand better. Part of our motivation was to, so that what I've described here is independent of space-time dimension, unlike the result of Komor-Gottske and Schwimmer, which is specific to two or four dimensions. So part of our motivation was to try to see if we could cook up a technology that would be that would generalize that to arbitrary dimensions. So far, that hasn't quite happened, but we have these other constraints that we've found that apply in NED. Okay, and I'll stop there. Thank you.
Time for questions.
Sorry, so the Komor-Gottske-Schwimmer four-point function would be derived from some 5D radian amplitude of this kind? Is that the idea?
Well, I was just making a QFT. I think what you just said is probably true, although I don't know the details. I was just making a QFT statement that the way that their argument is initially is phrased in the original paper is in terms of the effective action for the dilaton, and there's this d tau to the fourth term for the dilaton. You can rephrase their whole argument in terms of correlation functions, of course, and it's the correlation functions of the stress tensor trace. So in that way, the two things look sort of similar. I don't think it's quite the same correlation function. If you literally try to take the result and rephrase it in terms of the trace T, then it's some mixed up combination of four, three, and two-point functions. It's not just the four-point function that we were studying here, but they look similar.
If there's any connection to the Cassini proofs of the C theorem, because that sounds just because you were using this entanglement wedge to find the operator spreading.
Yeah, it's a great question. No, but that was also part of the motivation. I mean, okay, so let me say why I'm really bothered by the status of the C theorem, because we have all these great C theorems, they're wonderful. But what's really disturbing about them is that the arguments are depend on space-time dimension. So you have the C theorem in two dimensions, you have the F theorem in three dimensions, you have the A theorem in four dimensions. Cassini's methods make these a little bit more similar, but not completely. And in particular, we still can't tell from any of the methods whether there's a C theorem in five or six dimensions without supersymmetry. So that seems a little bit weird to me. Like, if this is really a fundamental universal fact about QFT, why do we need a different theorem in every, why do we need a whole different proof for a whole different theorem in every number of space-time dimensions? That's disturbing. Now, in holography, the derivation of the C theorem is very easy and independent of D. So if you could understand the holographic C theorems, It's just the fact that the radial direction flows in a certain way. If you could take the holographic C theorem and translate that into a statement about QFT, then I think maybe you'd have a dimension independent argument for the C theorems. We don't have that, but that was kind of part of the motivation of studying these quantities. I initially thought that maybe this that maybe this speed, or not, or more accurately, there's this picture back here. So there's this very natural positive quantity here, which is the time delay of a signal that's propagating through an RG flow. So I initially thought maybe that would be related to the C function. It is related in a complicated way, but they're not quite the same. So you can't really get from one argument to the other.
Great. Any other questions? Okay, if not, let's thank the speaker again.